Heartland Foods versus Mid-Atlantic Market et al. Mr. Wilkins.
Good morning, and may it please the court. At the outset, it's vitally important to understand the respective claims of each of these parties before we go into the substantive issues of what's going on here, and I want to take a quick minute to do that. Save-A-Lot's claims arise out of the failure of Midwest and Mid-Atlantic to pay for groceries supplied to their seven stores over a 2 to 3 month period culminating in March of 2000. By the time Midwest and Mid-Atlantic shut down their operations, Mid-Atlantic owed Save-A-Lot $500.
Wait a second, I'm lost now. Who do you represent?
Save-A-Lot.
Which side are you on?
Save-A-Lot.
Moran.
Save-A-Lot, exactly.
Okay, good.
By the time they shut down their operations, Mid-Atlantic owed Save-A-Lot $530,000. Midwest owed Save-A-Lot $766,000. There wasn't any real dispute as to whether or not this amount was owed, and by the time you tacked on the contractual interest at 22%, the amount of money which the district court found that we were entitled to was $2.3 million. In contrast, Midwest and Mid-Atlantic's claims relate to the delay in receiving three quarterly profit and loss statements in 1998. Those profit and loss statements were Save-A-Lot's obligation as part of an ancillary agreement to the big picture contracts for the operation.
Wait,
of
you're going much too fast. I've lost your thread completely. I thought there were two issues. One issue is whether they proved $3 million in damages from your failure to give them this accounting information for 3 months, and the other was this Equal Credit Act. Isn't that right?
That's absolutely right.
So isn't
right.
The first issue just whether Mid-Atlantic, whatever you want to call them, proved any damages, right? So
sure.
They didn't get their $45 worth of accounting information for 3 months, is that right?
And that's exactly the point, Your Honor.
The question is, you know what? So, what is the evidence of their harm from that?
We think the evidence of their harm is virtually nothing. They focused on two things. Throughout these proceedings, they really did almost nothing to get to the causation issue. They ended up focusing on two things, not really so much at trial as on appeal. Number one is they stressed the importance of this retail accounting agreement. The problem with that is they never went from why the contract was important to how the breach of the contract caused them any damages. This was a pretty minor part of this entire agreement. We're talking about three quarterly statements that were supposed to be provided 16 months before they incurred the debt that resulted in the judgment in their favor. You can't just go in and say this contract was important and not provide the evidence of why the breach of that contract caused damages. They completely omitted that at trial. They went completely past it and never addressed that issue. The jury was given nothing on which to award these damages. There was no explanation of costs that Midwest and Mid-Atlantic would not have incurred if we had provided them with the agreement. There was no profit and loss breakdown of where the problems in their company was. There was no evidence of what investments they would or would not have made if we had given them those agreements. There was no economic analysis of any kind whatsoever, certainly no expert analysis. The only thing the jury had on which to base its conclusion was the fact of the underlying judgment that we had already obtained against Midwest and Mid-Atlantic, and then counsel's statement at closing that $2.3 million judgment, when you added in interest, was worth $3,006,314. And that's exactly what the jury awarded. The jury went and did exactly what the district court said would be an unreasonable thing for a jury to do when the court ruled on summary judgment. They completely set off these claims for months and months worth of groceries provided to seven different stores. That can't be right. And the district court noted that can't be right in the summary judgment. The other thing that Midwest and Mid-Atlantic tried to do was they said, look, if we had just known this stuff, we would have shut down the operation earlier, or we would have tried to find another buyer. And that doesn't fly either. First of all, with all due respect to the standard of review, the evidence that they gave on this is completely contradicted by their own testimony. by November of 1998, they admit that they had a full understanding of what their financial situation was. They had hired an outside accountant, and they admit by then they knew exactly where they stood, and it was bad. And some of the language they used, it was hopeless to some of them. Nonetheless, they didn't shut this operation down until March of 2000. That's 16 months. And to top it all off, they went out and bought three new stores in early 1999. So on the one hand, they're saying, boy, if we'd have known this, we would have never gone forward with the business. We would have found a buyer. We would have shut it down. But in fact, they knew about it for at least 16 months before they shut it down. They spent all kinds of time trying to find a new buyer, and they were not successful in doing that.
Does the record show why they shut it down? I mean, what caused their stores to be unprofitable?
We called the note. We called the guarantee. Remember, they were paying, even after this breach, they were paying right up until shortly after December of 99, so say early January 2000. We let them go for a little bit.
No, but I mean something bad happened to their business, right?
No, the business it was consistently tanking. They were putting
That's what I mean. What happened to their business?
There is no evidence in the record whatsoever. The only evidence in the record was these stores were losing money from the get-go. They had a number that they needed to make every month, a nut. They never made it. Their expenses
It because the stores were in the wrong location, or there was a recession, is that just not on the record?
That's the problem, and your questions go right exactly to our argument. That was their burden to show. What was it that caused these businesses to fail, and specifically, how did our failure to provide this accounting service, how did it cause these operations to fail? There's nothing about that in the record. Nothing whatsoever.
Well, I suppose their argument is they would have mitigated their losses if they knew how bad they were. Was there anything about what is involved in closing a store? I mean, is it costless? Do you put a sign out on the door? What happens to a grocery store when it's closed?
I don't recall any testimony whatsoever, Your Honor, on that issue. The debt, which they claim that they're entitled to, that makes up their damages, was the amount that is still outstanding to Save-A-Lot. That's the only evidence whatsoever of damages. And remember, that number that the jury came up with was basically our judgment plus the interest that their counsel said. I was pointing out that one of their alternative theories was, well, we would have just shut the operation down. The another problem with that is it doesn't account for the entire judgment.
I'm just wondering what it means to shut it down. I assume it's not costless to shut these things down.
They stopped operating. I don't know. There was no evidence. Let's put it that way. There was no evidence of what the costs were. And when you look at the record, to be frank, there is none of the kind of evidence that you would expect to see in a case like this. There is no breakdown of accounting. There's no costs. There's no financial analysis at all. The only real numbers that are discussed are the underlying judgment. So I don't have a better answer for you, Your Honor, other than there was no evidence in the record on that issue.
Wilkins, there's no evidence with regard to leases or the amount of those leases? I'm assuming this property, in many cases, is leased.
There was some evidence as to initial startup costs, which were actually incurred.
Can't you derive from the startup costs? I don't know what they are, do they indicate what a monthly lease payment might be?
I don't recall what the specific numbers were. I assume they did. The startup costs were actually incurred by a different entity, Midwest Development Company. And even if there were, the problem is, how do you get from over here, 1998, when we don't give them three quarterly profit and loss statements, all the way over here to 2000 when those startup costs are not being incurred or recouped? There's no relationship there whatsoever. It's just, we had a contract with you guys. You didn't do what you were supposed to do. Our company failed. You owe us the money. There's no causal link whatsoever between over here and over here. And even if
what Chief Judge Flom is suggesting is that maybe they leased this space, and if they knew they were losing money, they could just walk away. I mean, is there something about the terms of the lease, whether there was a cancellation clause or something?
The walk-away was they declared bankruptcy.
What they're going to do is that. Is that what they were suggesting was their option, to declare bankruptcy?
That's what they did.
That's what they did.
That's what they did.
So is their argument they would have declared bankruptcy earlier?
Their argument is they would have, all they say is shut the stores down, close the stores, or found a seller sooner. Well, they spent a year trying to find a seller. They never could do it. So what close the stores means or meant to them is not at all clear from the record. As a practical effect, what it meant was they declared bankruptcy.
Did you mean to say try to find a buyer, or did you say seller?
Buyer. Did I say seller?
I
apologize. A buyer. They tried to sell the businesses.
Could they do that without your approval?
No. Actually, we had a provision in the contract that required our approval. There was actually a separate claim on that very issue on which we got summary judgment below and is not subject of this appeal. So we did have some control over that. But either way, they failed to do it. And the point being, they say they would have done it sooner, but they spent more than a year having full knowledge of what their financial status was, and they didn't do it then. Why should that evidence be given any credibility whatsoever, even enough to even get the case to the jury, when it's so contradicted by what they actually did? Even if you can get up that far, which I don't think you can, there are a couple of other flaws here. The entire judgment, which they're now essentially getting as a set-off, is comprised of Midwest and Mid-Atlantic. Okay? Midwest didn't even come into existence until after they admit they had full knowledge of their financial status. November 1998, they say they knew exactly what was going on financially. The Midwest stores weren't even created until early 1999. There's no way that portion of the damages, which is about $7.5 million plus the interest, relates to our breach whatsoever. Worse yet, there's no evidence we breached any agreement. As to Midwest, the time that we were not providing timely quarterly and profit and loss statements is before the time that Midwest even came into existence. So now we've got an even further reach between what we did and what we ended up having to pay as a result. There's no relationship there whatsoever. And what we're asking this court to do, I don't think, is very unusual at all. The securities cases, of which this court has one of the leading opinions in the Bastion case, it talks about this exact concept. You just can't come in and say, here's the deal, here's the breach, we've got damages and not prove causation. That's the concept of loss causation from all the securities cases. Similarly, the misrepresentation cases that we cited in the brief do the same thing. It's not as simple as just saying, had I known then what I know now, my business would have never shut down, or I would have made this decision or that decision. You've got to show, a plaintiff has to show, why the breach or the misrepresentation or whatever it is caused the damages. They just didn't do it. They just ignored it. And so in that sense, we think we're absolutely entitled to a directed verdict. At a minimum, we think we're entitled to a new trial, because there is no rational relationship between the evidence and this judgment, this $3 million judgment, that is clearly nothing more than a set-off of our original claim. I'd like to move on to the ECOA argument, if I could. When you look at this argument, like any issue of statutory construction, the first place you look is the statute clear? What does it say? And in this case, the statute is extremely clear. The statutory definition of applicant, which is the person who can recover on a private cause of action under ECOA, applies to someone who applies for an extension, renewal, or continuation of credit, or seeks to extend existing credit beyond the current limit. In layman's terms, the borrower. The borrower, under the statute, is the person who has a private cause of action. And the original regulations created by the Federal Reserve Board to put that into effect actually use the phrase other than a guarantor, surety, or endorser. When the regulations were revised, that phrase other than was turned into this term includes guarantor, surety, or endorser. That is a complete flip-flop of what the statutory intent was. The statute says the applicant, the borrower, if you will, not the third-party people who stand behind the borrower. The regulation says, well, we used to say that excludes guarantors, and now we're going to say that it specifically includes guarantors. Regulations can't do that. Our case law is very clear that a private cause of action has to be created by Congress, not by regulation. And again, this court has one of the leading cases on that in Miller Aviation, which follows the Sandoval line of cases. If a regulation announces an obligation or prohibition not created by the statute itself, it is not a valid creation of a private right of action, plain and simple. And that's exactly what happened in this case. The statute says one thing. Applicant means the borrower, does not mean guarantors. The original regulation says that. And then the original regulation, when it's amended, is flipped 180 degrees to now include guarantors. That's an improper exercise of board regulation discretion. The FRB cannot do that, and therefore the regulation is invalid, and Susan Camp does not have a valid cause of action under the ECOA. This court has rejected regulations that attempt to do that kind of thing before. In the Dormeyer case, in the Skokie Motor Sales case, this court has looked carefully at regulations that try to expand a private cause of action and said, you can't do that. When the statute says one thing and the regulation does something contrary to the clear intent of Congress as stated in the statute, that regulation is not a valid exercise of administrative power and is therefore void. And that's exactly what we're asking this court to do. We're asking the court.
Did the Federal Reserve Board give some reason for their why they thought guarantors should be
stumped
into this?
They did. They did give some reason. And what they said was because an issue of standing has arisen as to whether or not guarantors should have that right. There was no issue of standing.
But, I mean, did they explain that there's some problem with wives or husbands or what have you being, I don't know, coerced to be guarantors? Is that what bothered them?
The issue, as the Federal Reserve Board seemed to address it at the time, was that this is some sort of a loophole that guarantors could somehow avoid, let me put it the other way, the party extending credit could somehow avoid the effect of ECOA by requiring a guarantor, someone to sign a guarantee instead of signing the original application.
But did they explain that? Because I'm puzzled by that, because the original statute, you know, it's to enable women to get credit even
exactly.
if they're married. Okay.
Exactly.
So I don't understand what that has to do actually with guarantor. So I'm just wondering if the Federal Reserve explained how suppose you force someone to be a guarantor, that's still not a denial of credit. What did they say about this?
The explanation given by the Federal Reserve Board in the commentary, which we quote in our brief, does not provide a very good explanation. In fact, it does exactly what I think you're suggesting, Your Honor. It completely changes the statute.
Did they say there had been abuses?
All it says is this is a loophole for guarantors, basically. And the regulation and the interpretation, the commentary on the regulation, flips the statute right on its head, as you're kind of pointing out. The statute was intended to protect a woman's right to obtain credit. And that's good. That's a good and honorable purpose. We would all agree with that. But Susan Camp isn't trying to get credit here. Susan Camp is being asked to guarantee credit being obtained by Midwest and Mid-Atlantic. So this regulation and any explanation that was given, and I'll tell you that I don't think it was very good, it's not consistent at all with the statute. Not at all. It creates a completely different private cause of action than the statute ever did. Even if you would read this regulation as saying, okay, Susan Camp really is an applicant, then you also should conclude that Susan Camp is de facto a joint applicant for credit who therefore has no cause of action under the ECOA because she was in fact given credit. If a spouse is properly considered a joint applicant under the ECOA when joint assets are used to obtain the credit and when the spouse receives a direct benefit from the extension of credit, That's exactly what happened here. When Roger Camp applied for credit, he gave an asset list that included joint assets of both Roger and Susan. In fact, $5.2 million of the $8.2 million in assets on his statement of assets, either they belong to Susan either jointly or individually. So well over half are joint assets to begin with. Susan then received a direct benefit because she is the half owner of the development company that incurred the initial development costs. So if she's an applicant, she's also a joint applicant, and since she was extended credit as a joint applicant, she has no cause of action under ECLA. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkins. Mr. Palmer?
May it please the court. I've been doing appellate work for 24 years, and I have to admit that this case is one of the most complicated I've ever seen.
Well, I have an initial question just to complicate your life more. In your jurisdictional statement, you refer to the various owners of your companies and so on. That's fine. But in your statement of interest, you list another owner, Dixie Foods Incorporated. But you don't mention Dixie Foods in your jurisdictional statement. And you're supposed to, you know, give the citizenship of every member of an LLC.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that was an oversight on my part. And I cannot provide you the answer with the citizenship of that company now other than say that it is not an Indiana corporation.
You're sure of that?
I am sure of that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Let me back up, Your Honor. I did not do the independent investigation on that myself. I was told that by my client.
Okay.
The complexities in this case involve the interrelationship between the issues raised and the relief that would be granted by the court. If we could step back on the sufficiency of the evidence argument, if the court would affirm the judgment in favor of the corporations and Mr. Camp, that would eliminate the cross-appeal issues on the affirmative defense and recoupment theories that Susan Camp brings in the ECOA. Because if the judgment is affirmed, her guarantee is discharged.
Yeah, but the problem I have with that, with affirming, is so they have a judgment for $3 million something, and then you have this offset of $3 million, but I don't. I agree with Mr. Wilkins. I don't see any evidence of the actual harm that your companies incurred as a result of this accounting breach. Okay, you didn't get the information for several months, but what was the actual consequence of that? You talk in your brief about you would have shut down the stores or you would have sold them. But there's nothing about what it cost to shut down or what a buyer would have paid or why your firms were doing badly, why the accounting would have shown a loss. Where is that? This $3 million figure that the jury came up with is just doesn't seem to have any factual basis.
And I understand Your Honor's question. If I could answer it by backing up one step. And I will come to your answer.
Good.
I know that's not what I'm supposed to do.
But no, that's fine.
Backing up one step, when this case was initially filed and expert testimony, expert reports were to be exchanged, my clients had an expert witness who was going to testify as to and prepare reports as to all those factors, such as, you know, lost profits, lost future profits, and all those types of damages. What happened during the proceedings is that there were two requests for extensions of time in which to submit that expert's report. That expert's name is John Frizzell. The district court denied the second petition for extension of time to submit those reports, thereby excluding Mr. Frizzell as a witness in the case.
Your witness?
Our witness.
Okay.
So consequently, my client was left with a situation in which he had no expert witness to testify at trial. Consequently, the only evidence we were able to put on at trial was the evidence of Mr. Camp, the owner of the stores, who had experience in the grocery business and who testified as to the effect of not being able to see these reports.
But if the district court erroneously excluded your expert, you can complain about this. You know, you could get a new trial or something. But the problem is, if your witnesses are excluded and you just don't end up with evidence of damages, I don't see how we can sustain your $3 million verdict. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any factual basis for
Your Honor, don't take my explanation wrong. I did not concede that there's no evidence of damages.
No, I understand but if your evidence was truncated because of an erroneous judicial ruling, then that can be corrected, but you'd have to have a new hearing, right?
Well, Your Honor, let me also say that I don't think from an appellate standpoint that the court's ruling to exclude the expert was erroneous. There were two extensions. The district court, the magistrate, actually gave a good explanation why the report was to be excluded. That's why the issue is not raised on appeal. However, going back to your original question, the evidence to support the damages. Mr. Camp, well, to answer one of your questions posed to Mr. Wilkins, why did the stores go down? One, Save-A-Lot would not allow Mr. Camp to put into his stores local items. These are stores down in Virginia where local items such as local dairy products, meat products, sausage products would have a higher markup and would be more...
Wait. Now I'm getting... Maybe you're right. It's a very complex case. But I thought the issue about your damages was the consequence of the accounting... breach.
Correct, Your Honor.
Not of local items, right?
Your Honor, the local items...
How did the accounting breach, how did that hurt you? And what about it? He says that even after you got your... they belatedly give you the accounting information and you learn how badly the stores are doing, but you go ahead and you open more stores. So what's that about?
Those stores are open in a different part of the country, Your Honor, and the money from those stores, some of the money from those stores, was used to pay the debts of the Mid-Atlantic stores. And that's why you have two different corporations claiming damages. Mr. Camp is not a person who gives in easily. He fights to the bitter end, and he opened the new stores in the Dayton area in order to be able to offset the losses. But again,
Now you're pointing to something concrete. You say the new stores were opened in order to generate revenues for the old stores, and that's part of your loss. Well, how much was that? But we have to get up to this $3 million something. So how much was that figure? See, I don't see any figures here. So does the record contain an indication of how much... So the new stores subsidize the old. Okay, that's fine. So how much is that subsidy? Is that in the record?
No, it is not, Your Honor.
So really there are no numbers.
The only numbers, Your Honor, is the amount of the debt that the two companies ran
yeah,
up.
But what is the evidence that if it hadn't been for this three-month delay in giving your clients the financial information, you would have paid back the entire debt?
The evidence is that we would have paid back the entire debt. We would not have incurred the debt to begin with, Your Honor.
Okay, how would you have avoided the entire debt?
As Mr. Camp testifies in the testimony I set out in the brief, they would have insisted that Save-A-Lot allow them to put in local products, which would have had a higher margin of profitability, and would have reduced the amount of debt incurred. If that was not successful, they would have made changes in the management of the store. They would have changed their concentration on products, such as groceries have a lesser markup than meat products. Meat products obviously have a lesser markup than things such as Kleenex and things, you know, common dry goods. If that had not worked, They would have tried to sell the stores. If that had not worked, they would have simply closed the stores.
Yes, but how could one possibly know that all those alternative measures, or some of them, would have wiped out the entire $3 million debt? There are costs involved in all these things, aren't there?
Yes, sure.
Changing your mix of products, getting new management, closing stores, selling stores, and so on. That's all a costly business, isn't it? And
yes, it is, Your Honor, although there is no evidence as to those costs.
He didn't account for any of those costs. He didn't say, look, if we could have mitigated, I mean, that's what you're really talking about, mitigation. We could have mitigated our losses, and we would have saved $1 million or something. But how do you get up to $3 million whatever, you know?
Again, Your Honor, the only answer to your question is in the testimony that's quoted in the brief. I'm not going to tell you that there's other testimony floating around in the record somewhere. What the district court found to be sufficient to get the case to the jury is what is quoted in the brief.
Okay, so could I ask you about this equal credit thing, which I find baffling? So as I read the statute, it's just about how if a woman wants, if married, I'm looking at the married part of the statute, if a married woman wants credit, the bank can say, well, look, we don't lend money to married women because, you know, we're afraid you'll get distracted, you'll be have children or something, won't pay attention to your business. So that's illegal. That's what the thing is, the statute about. What I don't see is how that applies to guarantors. I don't get that. I mean, she's not being denied credit because she's married. In fact, she's not being denied credit at all. She's helping her husband to get credit by being the guarantor, and she's also has an investment interest she's protecting. So where is the discrimination against women or against married people in this case?
The discrimination in this case, Your Honor, is discrimination against both Roger and Susan Camp. Roger Camp was not granted credit on his own creditworthiness, although there is no dispute, and Save-A-Lot admits that they understood that Roger alone had the wherewithal to operate these groceries. But instead of giving him the credit on his own assets and his own ability, they insisted that Susan sign a guarantee. Now, that's discrimination against both Roger, because he had to have a guarantor.
But I don't understand. I mean, lenders are always looking for as big a pool of assets as possible.
Correct.
So if you're married or if you have a rich father or something, they'll say, oh, great, we want that person to guarantee. I don't know what that has to do with discrimination.
Well, I guess the only answer to that question is what the statute itself says.
Well, the statute doesn't say anything that bears on this. It's all about applicants for credit being denied credit because they're married. And there isn't any denial of credit here.
It's not only the denial of credit, but it is the requirement that's
But that's not
spot.
In the statute.
It's in the regulations, Your Honor.
There's nothing
correct.
In the statute. I mean, it's just about denial of credit. I don't see how, if you get the credit, you can complain about anything.
Your Honor, the purpose of the statute is not centered solely on the denial of credit. The purpose of the statute, as set forth in the statute, is to eliminate discrimination based on, among other things, gender and marital status in credit transactions.
It doesn't say.
Your Honor, I believe it's
well,
in.
No, it says discriminate against any.
I believe the statutory section is 16.
No, I understand. Suppose they weren't married. I mean, so what would that?
If they were not married, Your Honor, there'd be no discrimination based on marital status. He was required to have.
Well, he might not have gotten the credit, right?
He might not have. But the evidence in this case is that they never looked. They never even knew that the financial statement that he submitted included joint assets.
It's a pretty good guess.
The financial statement itself.
If you're married, you usually have joint assets, right?
The financial statement itself was entitled Financial Statement of Roger V.S. Camp. Save-A-Lot's testimony says that they didn't even look at the financial statement. They assumed that Roger had the wherewithal on his own to operate these grocery stores.
No, no, but as soon as you find out, as soon as a lender finds out that a borrower is married, he realizes that all or a large part of the borrower's assets may actually be a joint.
Community
not
property.
Reachable, right?
Could be community property in any particular state.
That may well be, Your Honor, but the fact of the matter is Save-A-Lot didn't care. They didn't care. There's nothing on that financial statement that indicates either that the assets were Susan Camp's or jointly owned assets. And that's what distinguishes this case from the cases.
Well, once they have her guarantee, they don't care anymore, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Once they have the guarantee.
But as I say, I mean, if you lent someone money to someone who is married, wouldn't you be concerned that the assets listed on the person's financial statement were actually joint?
You're
and then
right,
you'd
Your
insist
Honor.
On a guarantee, right?
I would definitely be concerned if there was no indication on there and I suspected that they were joint assets.
Right.
I would want an explanation of that.
Right. Without even a joint interest, the state laws may provide for the wife to have an interest in the property. And so you want her signature on it.
Yeah.
But, Your Honor, that's exactly what the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and the regulations enacted forbids. You cannot require a
spouse.
Do
you ever try to buy a car on time and find out the car's in your own name and see if you can get one without your wife signing it?
Actually, I have, Your Honor, and it's not easy.
It's impossible. But go ahead.
But that's what the Equal Credit Opportunity Act is designed to prohibit. You cannot require.
So all of those contracts are violations of the law?
If the signature of the spouse on a guarantee is required, and if the applicant alone is creditworthy.
But we're back to where we were before. You're creditworthy up to a point. You don't know whether he's going to, whether the state itself is going to intrude itself into that.
Correct, Your Honor. But in this case, Save-A-Lot, the testimony, the evidence is, and again, I guess we're at a sufficiency of the evidence argument here, whether there is evidence to support the jury's implicit finding that she was forced to sign the guarantee and that Mr. Camp was creditworthy on his own right. And the evidence supporting that is the testimony of Mr. Higgs, Save-A-Lot's own representative, who simply says, I didn't do any investigation on the financial statement. I assume Roger had the wherewithal to do it on his own. I didn't care if anything in there was joint or not. Mm-hmm. We just do it as a matter of course. Are there exceptions? Yeah, there have been an exception on some multimillionaire.
But isn't that very important to discrimination? That is, suppose Roger had complained and said, "Look, I don't want my wife to have to guarantee this because I'm rich. You don't need." What would Save-A-Lot have done then?
Right. In fact, Your Honor, Roger did complain. Roger said, "I can't take this to my wife; she won't sign it." And they said, "It's a matter of policy." And Roger took the guarantee to his wife, Susie. And said, you know, they want you to sign it. She said, no, I'm not signing that. I'm not part of the business. I have nothing to do with this. I don't know anything about groceries other than what I go to the store and buy. So he goes back to save. Roger goes back to Save-A-Lot and explains she doesn't want to do it. It's a matter of policy. She has to do it. Roger goes back. At that point, Susie says, well, we've already invested a lot of money in setting these things up.
We,
I believe so, Your Honor.
Well, if she's one of the investors, then she's a joint applicant.
Your Honor, I may have misstated that. I'm not sure, but the notion is that there was significant amounts of money already invested in getting this application, setting up, doing the market analysis. And I don't believe that they were her personal assets. No, Your Honor, I don't think there's any evidence of that. But her reason for signing that was that she did not want that money to be wasted. And I think that's sufficient evidence, together with Save-A-Lot's statement that it's our policy that everybody has to do that. That's sufficient to support the implicit finding of the jury that she was required to sign the guarantee.
Well,
And that was one of the issues that was raised in the trial court level, whether or not that she voluntarily signed that. And that, and the evidence what came through as it was.
Mr. Powell, can I take you back a second to the damage issue?
I wish you would, Your Honor.
I don't want to. The big number here, the big number here, obviously, is the damage issue. I've been reviewing again your comment about the testimony of Roger with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence. And I see he speaks in response to a question that if he had had the reports, he would have sought more flexibility. But did the initial agreement with Save a Lot allow for flexibility? I mean, in other words, once you enter into this agreement with Save a Lot, I mean, they can agree to changes, I suspect, in any contract. It can be renegotiated. But whether it's the meats or the non-meat products, wasn't he married to a situation where contractually he just was tied to the restrictions initially imposed in the sale of the groceries to the store?
Do you mean with the sale of the products in the groceries? Yes and no, Your Honor. Yes, the contract required him to stock the Save-A-Lot products and products approved by Save-A-Lot.
Mm-hmm.
No, in the sense that Save-A-Lot had made exceptions and had approved requests from other stores to allow the stores to stock products of local interest. And there is evidence of that in the record.
But are you saying Save-A-Lot broke the contract by not letting him stock local items?
No, Your Honor, we're not saying that at all.
But isn't Chief Jeff Flom correct that whether you had that flexibility was a matter of grace with them. You didn't have any right.
Correct, Your Honor. We had no right. And the testimony in the record that Judge Flom was referring to says that they would have pushed that issue harder with Save-A-Lot if they knew how much trouble they were in financially. And if that did not work, they would go to the next step. And if that didn't work, they'd go to the next step.
What was the on-site either capacity or actual, or if it's in the record, was Mr. Camp ever on the scene? I mean, I understand this reliance on these reports. Everybody needs those, I suspect. But as an experienced man in the field, how did it evolve to this state, I guess? Is there anything that speaks to that?
No, Your Honor, other than Mr. Camp lives in North Carolina and the story, the very badly failing stories in Lynchburg.
Did you earlier say he was an operator of stores or just an investor?
He was an operator of stores when he lived in South Bend, Indiana. He operated and owned stores that were named Family Fair. And coincidentally, some of those stores in the South Bend area have turned into Save-A-Lot stores. But he did have a background both as an operator and as an owner and as an investor in grocery stores. Your Honor, one thing I will disagree with you when you said that the big number is the $3 million.
Right.
It's a big number, but it's not necessarily.
I didn't mean it in a pejorative sense. We're talking 50,000 or so versus $3 million.
Okay. I don't want to de-emphasize.
50,000 as well as the $3 million.
I don't want to de-emphasize the issues raised in our cross appeal regarding the affirmative defense and the doctrine of recoupment. And I want to say I don't think it is explicitly stated in any of our briefs, but Susan's right to raise the judgment against her is not dependent on whether she is an applicant or whether the Federal Reserve Board exceeded its authority in making guarantors applicants under the statute. If she is not an applicant,
isn't your argument that if her rights under the Equal Credit Act, Equal Credit Opportunity Act, was violated, the whole $3 million debt is wiped out?
On the guarantee, Your Honor. Not the underlying debt, only her.
But it means she owes nothing.
She owes nothing.
But isn't that overkill?
No, Your Honor, I don't understand why it's overkill. Because if any part of that debt.
But if she had sued for a violation of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, her damages would have been much less than $3 million, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. So that's why, I mean, it's one thing to say the statute can be used in an affirmative defense. It's another thing to say it can be used to give you a measure of relief enormously greater than you'd be entitled to if you sued.
Your Honor, if she had filed an action against Save-A-Lot, she would have been entitled to actual damages, whatever those are considered to be, possibility of punitive damages, and equitable or declaratory relief. And that equitable or declaratory relief would have included canceling the debt on the guarantee. That's not what happened in this case.
But you see, that's so weird. That's one of the things that's weird about your idea that this thing reaches guarantees, because if you just look at the statute, okay, someone is denied credit, and then what are the damages that flow from being denied credit, being having to pay a higher interest rate or something like that? Well, that's all, you know, pretty straightforward stuff. But once you get into this guarantee business, you can have much greater consequences flowing from the violation. That's what is troublesome.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Mr. Wilkins?
I just want to address a couple of the questions that came up during Mr. Palmer's argument. The question as to whether or not Mr. Camp was on site, the answer to that question is absolutely yes. In fact, we cite a lot of testimony where Mr. Camp and Mr. Van Overloop, who was kind of his right-hand man, were very well aware of the financial situation of the stores even before they hired that outside accountant to come in and beef up their information. They were watching the figures on a weekly basis, and as you can imagine with any new store, they were worried about that.
Did he have contractually any room to negotiate with you on relief on some of the original demands or requirements, I should say, of the
I don't think
contract.
There would be any. There's no contractual provision that I'm aware of that he couldn't come back and negotiate. And we've got a vested interest in having these stores succeed. So certainly that was a possibility. For whatever reason, that never happened. There were negotiations to try to either get Save-A-Lot to buy the stores themselves or to work out some other arrangements, and those negotiations were unsuccessful. Camp and Van Overloop were monitoring the numbers on a weekly basis, and they knew they were never bringing in enough money to cover the expenses. When we were given...
Is Save-A-Lot in the business of operating stores?
We do have some company-owned stores, and we do have some loosely called franchise stores or stores that other people operate for us. So, yes, we do operate.
So something falls in between a franchise and a wholly owned, where you are very dominant in the operation.
There are certainly restrictions on what our operators are allowed to do and not do, and we do control that fairly tightly. Interestingly, I believe my understanding, my recollection is right, that was a basis for one of their counterclaims on which we got summary judgment, was that we weren't giving them enough flexibility to meet the needs of the local community. You know, they want this kind of product, and we're telling them, no, you got to sell that kind of product. So that's really a red herring, that this whole we would have sold different products. They raised that claim, and they lost on that claim, is my recollection. Judge Posner, you've asked a lot of questions, and I get the feeling we haven't given you satisfactory responses about what the evidence is, and that's because there is no evidence. The bottom line is there is no evidence that takes us from breach to damages. It's not the fault of counsel answering your questions, if you will. It's a fault of the absence of evidence that gets you from A to B. There just isn't any evidence.
Let me ask you about this credit issue. So Mr. Palmer says that Save-A-Lot refuses to give credit unless the spouse signs a guarantee, is that?
That's correct. The evidence was that...
No. You have a general rule you refuse to...
I think the evidence was that we have a general rule that's normally what we do. That's not to say there wouldn't be exceptions, but it's pretty typical for the exact reasons that
Judge Bauer was saying.
Right, that your questions have gotten to. And in fact, I want to correct one thing Mr. Palmer said. There was evidence below that we assumed that these were joint assets. He's correct when he says we didn't do any investigation, but I think that goes to Judge Bauer's question. We just assumed. Our guy on the witness stand, and this is at Supplemental Appendix 16 attached to our reply brief, he's asked, who did you believe were the owners of the assets listed on the asset list? And he says, well, I'm sure at the time I would have believed it was both Roger and Susan Camp. Question, why? Answer, well, primarily because it's listing residences. In fact, I believe there's more than one residence represented here. We assumed, and naturally so, we assumed that this asset list went to both of their assets. And the only way that that's relevant, the only way it's relevant, is if you get to the de facto joint applicant argument. If you stick with the main argument, which is there is nothing in the statute that authorizes this regulation to apply to guarantors, you never even address that issue. My time is up. Thank you.
Well, you actually had a minute, but
wrong light.
We'll take the minute back.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Palmer, I'm glad you're able to make it to court. I hope your family situation has improved. All right.